Okay. Good morning, everybody. So, we are on, I believe it's page 7. We're right towards the very end. We've been talking about kind of special cases. We've talked about a lot of the money principles that we've gone into in the past. And so, as we get here, the last one, I think we spent the whole class pretty much last time talking about retirement, saving up for retirement, caring for people who are going into retirement possibly. And so today we're going to start off with may Christians go into debt. May Christians go into debt. And I kind of thought, you know, again as a reminder, when we approach the scriptures, there's almost like five kind of layers that you want to think about. So you've got, like, number one is scripture might command something, right? So you must do this, right? And on the other end, on the five, you've got, right, it prohibits. So the opposite. You must not. And then there's some things that are maybe it's kind of neutral on, right? Do you buy a red car? Do you buy a blue car, right?
Blue.
Well, of course, red and blue, ideally, right? Neutral on, right? And then there may be things where maybe it might encourage or discourage. Where it's more like should or should not. Where it's like a warning to do something. Like this is risky to do this. And so when we think about some of these ideas, you kind of have in your head, like, where might certain behaviors, where might certain actions fall? Is this something that I am commanded to do? Is this something that I am encouraged to do? Does this kind of make sense? So when you think about your, like the conversation last time, your retirement, right? What is it that scripturally I'm commanded to do? Well, I'm commanded to as much as I can to provide for the members of my own household. And so how do I do that? Well, there's things that I can do in terms of working hard and saving up. But there's a lot of specifics that aren't specifically commanded in how you do it, but there's things that you could be encouraged in.
Would you say, would you put like two and four in like the category of wisdom or conscience?
Yeah, so I would say that wisdom is a lot of times, you know, if you kind of draw your circle like this, right? If you talk about, you know, what God's prescribed will is here, and you've got sin out here, right? So anything you're prohibited in doing is out here, right? But as you get closer and closer to sin, and you become more and more foolish, right, and you approach that sin. So I would say, yeah, as you kind of move down this line, you're kind of moving away, but there's freedom and wisdom in there to make some decisions as you're growing and as you're maturing. Okay, does that kind of make some sense? Okay, so let's look at a couple of scriptures that maybe talk about debt first. So I have a volunteer, we're gonna read Leviticus 25, 35 through 38. They wanna jump in here. Okay, go for it.
If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. You should not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God.
Okay, so let's first kind of think about this passage. Does it forbid all lending? What would you say? You ready for a why or why not?
Yep.
Okay, so yeah, why is the interest key?
Well, specific to a brother who's poor. Mm-hmm. So basically, don't be a slumlord.
Okay.
Don't profit off of the vulnerable.
Don't profit from the vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to add to that? Yeah, so there's some key things in there that the passage is really talking about, like taking advantage of someone more than the actual practice of the borrowing and lending. And so we see that from the brother's poor. What else do we see about the brother? Can't maintain himself, right? So he's very, right, in a very tough situation, right? And as A pointed out, it doesn't necessarily say that you shouldn't lend to him, but it kind of qualifies the way in which you might do it. Not at interest, not to profit off of his dire situation. Okay. What about Proverbs 22:7? The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave to the lender. Oh, I can hear Dave Ramsey right now. So what do you think? What about this one? Does it forbid borrowing or going into debt?
Proverbs is more like a set of general principles. Uh-huh. It's not necessarily like a command. So it's saying that the general principle is that the rich rules over the poor, and that if you borrow, then you'll just like keep borrowing and become a slave, which is partly why Leviticus tells that to not take advantage of
Others. Yeah, point out some good things. It kind of is a descriptive in one sense, right? It's not necessarily commanding, but it's describing the nature of how debt and borrowing works.
On your list, may that be number 4, discouraging?
I think so. I think it's saying that if you borrow, know the situation that you're placing yourself into, right? You're indebting yourself to this person. So what does that do when you think about lots of different ways of debt?
Yeah, the other thing too, it seems to be the rich is the lender and the poor is the borrower.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in both cases it's the poor is truly enslaved because they don't really have assets or whatever to. Yeah, so there seems to be like if you're poor, payday loans may not be what you need. You know, those type of exploitative practices.
Okay.
Not a business to business loan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he's pointing out that there's a connection in this passage between the rich and the poor and the borrower and the slave. Yeah.
Oh, no.
No? Yeah? Okay. So what do you think? How does that affect? Think about all the ways that maybe in our... We're trying to think about that time where often it was the poor who were in great need. They needed food. They needed a place to live. They needed clothing. They were in this situation where they were needing to borrow, and that we have these regulations and these kind of descriptions of it. You're becoming servitude. So thinking about how would that apply? How does that affect our view of borrowing and maybe a more... wealthy or just a richer nation, a richer time, how does it affect our view of debt and borrowing? What about these couple of verses? Judy, what you got?
I think a person needs to be very careful.
Yes.
In this day and age, it is way too easy to borrow. It's much easier to borrow than it is to pay back.
Okay, so...
With credit cards being the way they are, some credit cards will approve just about anybody, and then you get in trouble.
Yeah, you have to have a pulse.
I steer away from them because I get in trouble.
Yeah,
so
that's good.
So I just don't have them. That removes the temptation because people look at credit cards. Okay, I've got this credit card.
Uh-huh.
I can buy this.
Yes. Sometimes they're...
But they forget it has to be paid back.
Right. So that's a good point you bring up. So debt, right, that's a future burden, right? If you're taking on future work, future burden. And it's not necessarily that amazing to say, to get something that says, I've been pre-approved for all this money, right? Mm-hmm. They're kind of warn people, right, their freshman year of college, you get on campus and get a free t-shirt and sign up and get this credit card. Oh, yeah. And then all of a sudden they get this card and I don't know if you guys have known people, but yeah, they come and they're real kind of financially illiterate, and they just think that it's just free money. I don't know. So you got debt, right? There's a sense in which we have to realize that it's this future burden that we're going to have to pay off. What else? How do these verses kind of help us think about debt itself? How we can use it or not use it? Yeah?
It's all these principles are based off of the fear of the Lord.
Uh-huh.
Like not lending at interest.
Uh-huh.
Talked about this. But fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. So just have his presence inform all of our decisions. And that'll give wisdom. I hear in business, you're always lending and being, like, you're almost always in debt somehow, but you also have different assets. Like, it, just how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just our modern debt.
Mm-hmm.
But also make your decisions in light of who God is,
mm-hmm.
and with the wisdom of others around you.
So. Yeah. Yeah, and I think you bring a good point. Like, thinking about it from this, sometimes we often think about it from the standpoint of the borrower, right? How does it influence? But as we're saying, when you think about not lending out interest, if you're in the position to loan out that money, personally or in a business, that kind of affects the way in which you do that. Yeah.
So why are you going into debt? Is it pride issues? You
mm-hmm.
want the newest silver auto block?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Is it a business move that will be recouped and profited, or is it because I want to work?
Yeah, there is a different sense of financial system now where there may be situations, you talked about business, where people will borrow and take out debt for things where they have the cash to pay for it, and they may do it to reduce their tax liability. There's different reasons why they may do that. I think that there is a sense in which we talk about that idea of, right, when you talk about when you're a slave or servant, right, who do you owe, and are you incurring any kind of risk? And so what's the difference between, say, borrowing $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 on, say, a credit card, a car, a home? What are differences there to think about? Kind of some wisdom issues. Judy, what's the difference?
You ask yourself, is this going to diminish in value?
Yes, depreciate.
A home, usually, not always.
Yeah.
Usually appreciates it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas a car depreciates at least $1,000 when you drive it on the
There you
floor.
Go. There you go. Yeah.
It doesn't make any difference whether it's new or used. It depreciates as soon as you sign that piece of paper taking over the debt to pay for that.
Yeah, so we're kind of in this question where I want you guys to be thinking about, like, what are some good or right reasons to maybe borrow, or some bad or poor reasons to maybe borrow. So Judy brought up, does it depreciate or appreciate in value? Yeah.
So oftentimes when we go into debt or encourage going into debt for something, you think that by borrowing you'll be freed to get what you want.
Yeah.
The principle here is that usually when you borrow, you're actually becoming enslaved
mm-hmm.
to the lender. So it's a mindset. I'm not actually being free to get what I want. I'm actually being enslaved. But then things like in our current age, buying a house, for example,
mm-hmm.
It's pretty much impossible to buy a house with cash unless you get an inheritance.
Yeah.
A normal, middle class person. And so if you're paying rent for 40 years, all the money's lost.
Yeah.
Versus getting a reasonable house with a reasonable debt that you can
mm-hmm.
pay off reasonably with your income,
mm-hmm.
then it becomes something that actually can free you
mm-hmm.
to use your funds differently. So kind of that question of, is it really freeing you or is it enslaving you? There are a few cases where it might free you, but you have to think carefully about that.
Yeah, and I think what you hit, one of the things you hit on that's really key is that, like, for example, in a mortgage or in a house where it's just very, very difficult to think about doing that in cash, oftentimes the terms of that debt and the terms of that indebtedness and servitude are vary in terms of their risk, right? So borrowing $100,000 on a home that you have a 30-year mortgage is different than borrowing 100 and putting it into Bitcoin, right? That's something that's very volatile, right?
I wish I'd done that.
Oh, come on. Yes. Depending on when you bought it and sold it, yes.
Yeah, I think you have to, when you kind of look at modern accounting, like if you buy a house, you do have an asset. So technically you're not in debt. Your net worth is flat. It's
right.
It's level. That's very different from, let's say, financing a trip to Tahiti, where your net worth goes way down and you're borrowing against that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, let's say you take out a car loan because you have a really good investment over here, and you could pay it off, but you choose not to because you think your money's making more over here than you're losing with interest. Mm-hmm. So there's financial considerations where it's not really a debt decision. Mm-hmm. It's more of an allocation of resource decision. Mm-hmm. So just because you get a loan doesn't necessarily mean you're going into debt. Does that make sense? Like buying a house, you're getting collateral.
Yes, yes. I think that's kind of what I was getting at with when I think about like credit card and car and home, they're kind of like three different categories for me because generally the home appreciates in value. And so you're not necessarily, oftentimes you're not necessarily losing a lot of the money that you're investing or borrowing. Whereas a car, you do get an exchange, so you have something, but it's not an asset generally because it doesn't produce more income and it generally depreciates, but it slows the rate at which, so as you said, if you buy it new, it's going to depreciate, you know, a lot faster financially. The older it is, it's kind of a percentage wise. But you still have some sort of something that represents that debt. It is very common, the newer cars that you buy and borrow, oftentimes people get upside down on those very quickly because the loan amount, the car can depreciate quickly. And then credit card debt, if it's trips, if it's entertainment, if it's going out to eat, there is nothing to represent that debt. And so now you're indebted for, and you have nothing kind of to show for it or to sell or to trade in. So that's just something to think about category-wise, like what am I indebted to and what type of risk am I taking on? Andy.
So two things. Do you think it's ever right to take out a loan or have debt on a depreciating asset? And credit cards, I can make the argument that if you're using a credit card, you're probably living outside your means. So that's not wise. Just two thoughts.
Okay.
Also, how do you build credit for a home if you don't use a credit card?
Manual underwriting.
Okay. All right. So I can see that we're getting around some convictions here. We're getting around some convictions. So, depending upon your personal convictions, you're going to answer that very differently. So, Carissa and I have, you know, we've done at the time credit cards and build up points and high credit scores and tried to, you know, but for us and for me personally, I really put some stock in the psychological difference of a credit card versus a debit card, where it comes out directly and you automatically lose it versus the psychology of you spend it, and then at the end of the month you pay it off.
And you're getting rewarded for it.
Right, right. So I'll be very cards on, hands on the table, whatever you call it, show you my hand. I'm similar to like a Ramsey that I'm gonna avoid borrowing as much as possible. And so it is possible to borrow for a home if you have a job, you can show you've paid your bills, et cetera, et cetera. But the credit score just, it demonstrates that you are a person who is able to consistently pay your bills. And so the argument is that numbers-wise, this is the question is it a numbers thing or is it a mental thing that how credit affects you? So there are ways in which using credit cards, you may be able to work the math to gain an advantage and a benefit, but oftentimes the psychology behind the way it may affect our spending, it may be the way it's often said is, you know, are you able to kind of outsmart the psychology of the billion-dollar industry that's built to try and get us to spend more? So that's kind of the issue. Now, is it, you know, is it, I think you kind of ask, is it, so I wouldn't say it's sinful to borrow money on a depreciating asset. I think it's not a wise choice, but there's little in the scriptures that talk about how you must, you know, increase your net worth by 10%, you know, every year, whatever that is. We're meant to be good stewards, but there's a lot of openness in terms of what that means.
Yeah, and I think it depends on the depreciating asset. Like if you were to buy a combine, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that depreciates in value, but it adds value to the overall operation.
Yeah, and all cars depreciate.
Yeah,
so,
but they add
value. Yeah, and so the question is, you could make the commitment that I'm only gonna buy, you know, a car in cash, and depending on what your situation is in life, that may be very difficult if like you're transporting family or you're trying to work at a job where you're trying to get to. It may be that you borrow some for a car, but Judy.
And as you age, your perspective of going and getting for things is completely different because most of you people in here to me are children yet.
Okay.
I have reached a point where I have just X amount of income with no possibility of overtime or anything to cram in some extra money. So as you age, you have to be, or at least should be, more careful with your money.
Yeah.
Not saying that when you're young you shouldn't become careful with your money, because if I'd been a better steward with my money when I was younger, I would possibly have a little money right now. But he was talking about renting versus owning. I rent now. I'm in a good spot. I live in HUD housing. They take care of everything. I mean, they pay taxes, utilities, do the yard work, do repairs. My refrigerator goes bonk. They replace my refrigerator at no cost to me.
Yeah. I think one last thing I would share is that I have seen a lot of, I don't have TikTok, but I've seen little short like YouTube video type things, right? And so often there's this idea that that debt can be a really good thing because it means, oh, you're not gonna pay taxes. And so I don't know if you guys have seen people talk about this idea that, oh, you're not gonna be taxed on your debt because you owe money. So just to kind of bring up this idea that, yeah, when you take on debt, right, because you are incurring that risk and incurring that money that's kind of leveraging for your business or your personal, it's not counted as, you know, income. So you may avoid paying taxes on this large borrowing, but you're incurring this amount of interest or debt. So sometimes they say, well, I don't want to pay taxes, but they kind of, the interest / risk is kind of what they're exchanging. And so people that want to avoid, right, if you want to avoid paying, it's either taxes or interest, paying a lot of interest and incurring a lot of risk, sometimes you pay for things outright and you may have a higher income and you may pay more taxes. And so there's kind of a trade-off in your financial picture, whereas the tax law is kind of set up to favor those and to tax less people who are financially worse off. And so to present and borrow a lot of money, you may be able to leverage that for your personal or for your business finances, but you're incurring a good deal of risk and interest in exchange for trading off and trying to get out of that taxes. So I think the situation as you grow, right, when it comes to debt, make sure you understand the terms, whether it's right, payday loan, a car loan, a bank loan, right? Who are you borrowing from?
We have a lot of students in here. What about
Yeah, so what would you guys say? Student loans, you've got, right, the house category, this is you're borrowing for something that's going to appreciate in value. You've got the car where it's like kind of an exchange for something that might not be in as much of value, or you've got the credit card debt where it's just going to, any thoughts on how you'd classify a student loan? Are there any kind of factors that influence?
Student loans are like such a, the way they're structured is a pretty bad system that I think really does take advantage of vulnerable. And coming from somebody that did take student loans and it was with just a mess to try to get through. So there's a lot of things about student loans that are different than other loans. So your interest at the end of the year becomes principal. So your principal actually grows if you don't cover all the interest, which is just a problem because that can roll and roll and roll, and people can make their minimum payment 10 years later, have a higher principal than when they were when they first started. So it is they're really bad loans as far as wisdom goes. And I wish somebody would have just told me when I was in school, if you just get a job and pay $400 or $500 a month for your stuff, you'd be fine. But you know.
Yeah, they are different. So when we talk about understanding the terms of your loan, you know, student loans are different in that way. They don't get wiped out through like bankruptcy. They're kind of like permanent. And there's been some talk about the last few campaign promises about forgiving them. I will say I can think of one example where I had a friend from high school, very small rural town we came from. Came from a pretty meager family that wanted to be an optometrist. So he had a 4-year undergraduate and 4 years of, you know, optometry school. So I think he was, by the end of those 8 years, near like $500,000, $400,000, $500,000 in debt. But he, you know, started working, you know, married another optometrist. They eventually opened their own clinic, sold that clinic. So paid those off very quickly because he, and this is kind of the example I'm going for. In his case, the degree that he earned through that debt truly paid off. See that why? So it turned out to be a good investment because he did very well financially. But that's kind of the key thing with student loans: is the degree you're getting really necessary and helpful for what you need to do for a living, right? And so like you're saying, talk to people in your industry of what you're doing. Do you need a degree? What kind of a degree do I need to get started? Should I get a master's or just get those type of things?
I think because we're talking marriage and money, the way that this plays in that instance as well is the burden that it puts on when you get married, and especially when you decide to have children and you want to be home. You want your wife to be home. There's an added burden to that you may not be thinking about right now. You're living in the moment. You don't have any prospects right now. So I think that is, I've just seen many people, really have to struggle with that. Or then also then getting in a spot then where you can't buy a house. There are things that you can't do because of that debt when you have a family.
This is my family. This is the wife right there. So, there they are. I know. They really, really long neck. All right, people. All right. They're going to be shorter people now. Short.
Draft bodybuilders.
And this person's legs are going to be the same length. Okay. So, when they get married, right? You've got kind of the burden is, right, to provide for their needs. So, what. And kind of what you're saying, I think what you're saying is bringing up the idea that if you come into that and you've got like student loans, right, it kind of adds the weight on there. Of you have to not only provide for your current needs, but that's now the future's kind of coming back to you. Because that debt was a future burden that you're putting off until later. And kind of like what Dan was saying is that if you could go through college either by preparing ahead, right, saving or working or a combination of those two, you're keeping that burden from following you into your future. Right, you're starting off with a clean slate, so that you're able. And I think that that's, I think one of the really key things about this is not just borrowing and also like your spending, but depending on how you start, it really does set a foundation for your marriage. And if you start off having to both spouses work, it makes it really hard to then change your quality of life to say we're going to go to one income. So in terms of providing for your needs, if one thing Carissa and I always did was at the beginning of our marriage, we both worked, but we budgeted so that we were just living on my income. And we saved that money saying we're going to use that to buy our first house or something that we're going to need in the future, but we will never be dependent upon it, so that when we want to start a family, we won't have to change the quality of our life. We won't have to reduce our spending. And that was really good. She worked, we saved that, and then that's what we used as our down payment on our first home. And so when you think about marriage and preparing, bringing into your marriage, it's good to have that conversation about, okay, are we bringing any debt in, right? How are we going to address that? What are we going to pay off first? Or can we come into this clean slate? You know, how are we going to provide? Andy.
I was going to say, each college is in a different spot and has different opportunities and different families that help them and don't help them. But if you are taking out student debt and you don't have a job while you're in college, that's probably not a wise thing to do. So I would just encourage you, if you're like, I know it seems like this is the time to enjoy college and have the college experience, like everybody just preaches to you in college. Mm-hmm. But if you can work a little bit and pay some of that down now, it's going to put you in a way better spot when you start a big kid job.
A big kid job. Yeah. And, you know, really weigh the idea of the cost of your degree in terms of both time and money versus the, right, what is the value, the future income, right? Think about, really know your field, right? Am I going to be a carpenter, electrician, I'm going to be a plumber, I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be an attorney, construction, what am I looking to earn here? And kind of do that math. Okay, if I borrow and don't work, right, how many years will it take me to kind of make up for that, pay that off, and what will I have to live at? Will I have to suffer? Judy.
Something that no one has mentioned as of yet, for those who are brainiacs and can maintain a certain GPA,
oh,
there is scholarships.
Yes, there are.
That can also supplement,
yeah,
your college expenses.
Yeah.
Partial, and then there's full scholarships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point. I always stress to my students that you got two ways to earn money in high school, right? You can work at a job that pays you directly, or you can work at your studies and earn money in terms of gaining a scholarship and high test scores, those type of things. Joshua.
Two more practical considerations for college students. One is that if you plan on getting married, like you said, if you book a student debt, you now have double. So think about it in terms of caring for your future spouse. So maybe you're thinking $20,000, I can do that. Now you have $60,000 or $100,000 when you get married. And that's when you can feel crushed pretty quickly. And the other is, when you get used to having debt, you think, well, paid off over the next 30 years. And I would just encourage you, as soon as you graduate and you get like a real job, live like you're a poor college student and pay it all off as fast as possible. I knew a girl in college with the master's. I think she had like $35,000 in debt. And she's a school teacher in LA, they paid like $50,000. So she lived off $15,000, she paid the entire debt off in 1 year. Something where I think most people would have paid that off over 5, 10, 20, 30 years. And so she lived with four or five girls and just did it. So I say keep living poorly until you can live debt-free. Particularly in those early years, you have more freedom to do that. Once you have a spouse and other things, it's harder to live with just rice and beans and the five other guys.
Yeah. Very true. Very true.
I don't know what will change in 30 years. Like as far as health issues and medical bills that can come on top of that. And if you have a family, their health issues. Like to pay it off over that long of a time, you don't know what will happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've been looking at a lot of, in terms of debt, in terms of like a way of acquiring, right, money by borrowing it instead of earning it, working for it. And so on the other side is, we've got two ways to kind of adjust that. There is living, you know, on lower amounts or gaining. So thinking about how you can earn more money, work harder, work longer, work at a better job. So both of those are different ways. Give yourself a bigger shovel, right, to bring in a better income. Or decrease your kind of living standard. Any other kind of closing? We're going to transition to point number the one about C. Does the Bible allow for mothers to work outside the home? Pamela kind of hinted at, like, as a good segue, right? We talked about how debt can influence your ability to do that or not. So that's kind of a question that when it comes to finances and marriage, should, so where does this, if you're a wife and or a mother, both, right, where does that fall in terms of working outside the home? That's a good question to ask yourself. Does the Bible command you as a wife to work outside the home? Does it prohibit you, discourage you, right? How does the Bible portray this? Okay, so let's look at a passage from Titus. I have a volunteer who wants to read Titus 2, 3 through 5. Go, Salma. You got it.
Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled.
Okay. Yeah, so gives instructions, right? The older women are be teaching the younger women this, right? So we don't really have many older women, of course, in here, but the older of the group can be teaching the younger of the group. So let's kind of count them off. How many kind of specific things, what are things to teach them or train them? What do you see there?
What is good?
What is good? Where's, oh yeah, verse 3. Okay, so what is good? Any more details on what that is? What's the first thing?
Love their husbands,
number one. Number two, love their children. Number three, be self-controlled. Number four, pure. Number five, working at home. Number six, kind. Seven, submissive to their own husbands. Right? So it gives us at least seven specific things. All right. So do any of those speak to the idea of a wife and a mother working outside the home?
These commands?
I believe they are to teach them to do this. So I would say, yeah, there should be self-control. They should be pure. Should be working at home. So,
I mean, I guess the question is, what is working at home? Because I see like Proverbs 31 woman.
Yeah.
That she's like a, let's see, she's like the ships of a merchant. She brings her food from afar. She rises while it is yet night and provides.
Yes.
There's a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hands, she plants the vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes herself strong. She perceives that her merchandise is profitable. Her lamp does not go out at night. She put her hands to the staff. And her hand holds the spindle. She opens her hands before and reaches out to the hands of the needy. So, like, if all of that, like, if that's working. That's
it is.
Working.
Yes.
Yeah. And, I mean, I guess that's what it's trying to get at. Work,
mm-hmm.
Be a hard worker, provide for your family in unique ways.
Okay, so yeah, working at, what does it mean? What does it look like? And so I think the question is, like, is there a way to work at home and is working outside the home, is it like this? Like, it's either or? Is there an overlap where you can work outside the home and still be considered to be working at home? So in Proverbs 31, right, we're talking about the godly woman, right? The example of a godly woman, a godly wife, how she blesses her husband, blesses her children. Excuse me, sorry. So let's first establish. So is this passage, when it says working at home, does it prohibit the woman from working outside the house?
Yes.
No. It says they, but it does command them, number one, to be workers at home. So when we think about that, does that mean that all of her work could be done outside the home? And that's all of her work? No. It means that any work that's done outside the home would be in addition to or alongside of the work that's done at home. Okay? Does that principle kind of make sense? Yeah.
I think I've heard it said that the mother, the wife's priority should be home and the people of her home. And that may mean working outside of the home to do that, but her is always at the top to be about the people of her home. And so it can't be I go to work and I don't do anything at home.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah. Or I go to work to escape home.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And that's very, it's a very common thing that I have heard from women that I'm a better mom when I get, I'm away from my kids. Well, I don't know about that.
I think my question is whether the emphasis would be that you must work at home or if the emphasis is working, like Josie was talking about. I think, well, I'm wondering how many opportunities were there for women during this time period to work outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
So is the working at home part specific to that context?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so is there any clues in there as to whether or not it's referring to the home and what they mean by home in that context? Yeah.
So how about today's society where the wife's job pays way more than the husband,
mm-hmm.
and so then the stay-at-home dad type deal.
Mm-hmm. So look, well, let's look at the text first. So I'm going to kind of tie these together. So is there anything in the text that could influence our view of like what is it? What does that mean, working at home?
The other commands in that are all matters of things that kind of not all of them, but mostly kind of take place in the realm of the home where you're submitting to husband and training children, and I guess being self-controlled obviously is outside of the home, but there's this context of the family,
mm-hmm.
the home, that kind of puts that into context, I guess.
Yeah, so we see here, right, it's a command given specifically to older women, to younger, and they're teaching them what's good, and there's a focus on loving their husbands and children and working at home, submissive to the husband. So it seems to be in the realm of the family, right? In the realm of the husband and the children. So that context kind of gives it an idea that in that home where they're loving their husband, they're loving their children, they're submitting to their husband, they should be workers in the home. It's not necessarily giving. One thing I thought was really neat about this passage is that if you notice, there's no negative commands in this passage. There's seven positives. Do this, do this, do this. And so oftentimes we have passages that say, do this, but don't do this. Put this off and put this on. And when we have positive commands, the idea is that as long as you aim for and fulfill and hit this target of positive, that kind of defines what you may or may not do otherwise, so long as you are aiming for and achieving this goal. So if there's a wife that is doing all of these things and alongside of that has these Proverbs 31 businesses or jobs that can enrich the family, bless the kids, bless the husband, help their family meet their financial goals, that's one kind of, if you look at the question, right, that would be a noble reason for kind of working outside the home. Yes?
See, this fits. Nancy Piercy, in her book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, makes an interesting argument that up until really the industrial era, that husbands and wives almost always worked together,
yeah.
in a home setting.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the challenge of understanding this is that we've so divided our families where
mm-hmm.
the husband leaves and goes somewhere else,
uh-huh.
or the wife, she works, has to leave and go somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
But throughout much of history, there's been a more collaborative effort in the home. So.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some of our agricultural brothers and sisters and farmers around here, they have a better sense of some of the husband and wife working together
uh-huh.
on the land.
Uh-huh.
So So there's definitely this emphasis on making sure that your home is cared for well as a priority for the woman. But within that, there's a great deal of a freedom to flesh that out, like you're saying. And it is, but it is challenging. You know, how do you flesh that out in a world where husbands and wives are no longer centered around collaborative home work?
Yeah, yeah. And I think the key thing is that some of us put in the word only, kind of subconsciously, working only at home. And what does that look like in, like you're saying, in our modern day culture? Well, maybe since COVID, there's a lot of at home, right, remote working, but we can kind of see it differently than when it was, you know, your job was at your home. You're a blacksmith or you're, right, you're whatever, and you live there, you're a baker. Yeah.
And I'd even say some of the occupations, even back then in ancient Near East, like being a soldier or traveling for business, was really the province of the males. Mm-hmm. Because it was dangerous to travel and to leave the home. So that wasn't the case. That wasn't every case.
Yeah.
But
you have the fishermen, you have the shepherds.
They're the ones who actually leave, go out into the fields and leave the home. But I do think, you know, talking about Casey's point, women make better mothers than men. They are much better, in general, of caring and nurturing young children. They just know what to do with babies. And I mean, I can testify, like, I was able to bathe my babies, but other than that, I felt kind of useless.
Okay.
They
made it, though.
They made it.
They made it.
No thanks to me.
Survived.
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of times, I think when we get into this discussion, we talk about what women can't do, as opposed to narrowing the field and talk about, well, let's talk about what they do better than anyone else and what they do really well, and that is to nurture life.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the really good points maybe to kind of end on is that, you know, when you're, we talked about how debt, right, and you bring debt into marriage, it's a burden on both of you. You bring it together, you become one. So when you have a vision for what you're going to do as a couple, when you get married, you become one, you're both working, right? You're both working towards the same goals.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means that the husband may go out and work at a job, but when he comes home, he should still be working at home together.
Yeah.
The wife may go out and work outside the home, but when she's home, she's still working at home. Like, you're both constantly working. And so really it's a division of who is to do which roles, which jobs, who's better at mowing the yard, who's better at cooking the meals, who's better at the laundry and fixing the car, right? You want to have a clear communication of the division of those labors, because both of you are going to be working. It's not like you have ever really have the choice of I'm going to work or I'm not going to work. It's the type of work that you're going to do. And how do you share that in such a way that you're kind of, you know, focusing on your strengths, right? It's possible a lot of times where man and woman can both do the same roles, but one's often better than the other. So,
we got another week.
One more week. We'll do one more week. So let me pray for us. Thank you so much, Father, for your word. I thank you that as we talk about men and women and husbands and wives, that your word gives us guidance. And I pray that we would just really dig deep into what you guide us to do. I thank you for, as we were looking at the commands and the instructions that the older women are to teach the younger. And I pray that as we look at our own marriages, or as we look at becoming married in the future, that we really think deeply about how we can glorify you in both our role as either husband or wife, how we can love one another truly, and how we can glorify you by how we divide up the labor that comes with a marriage and even raising children in the future. We give you thanks for just this discussion of money. I pray that it would just continually encourage us to look at your word, to study it, and to examine how it can really give us great freedom to serve you and to honor you as our Lord. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.